Cost versus value, cost versus benefit, investment versus expense. When someone says, and it doesn't make a difference whether it's a service or a product, and the dollar value makes no difference, when someone says something like, that's a lot, or that's expensive, your immediate response is a pause and then a question. Compared to what? If someone, for example, consults with a chiropractor, hey, remember, I practiced chiropractic in San Diego for nearly 30 years. And after the evaluation, the doctor gives a report of the findings and tells the patient the fees involved, and the patient says, that's expensive. The doctor would pause, or at least what I did and what I teach chiropractors to do or other doctors to do, the pause and ask, compared to what is this expensive? Compared to not being able to play with your children or grandchildren? Compared to not being able to get a good night's sleep? Compared to not being able to work? Compared to not being able to go on vacation? Compared to surgery? Compared to what is this expensive? And then the person asking that kind of question, in this case the doctor, goes into silence. And later on we'll talk about the power of silence. All of a sudden there's a different perspective. When you offer a comparison, everything changes. If you're buying a pair of slacks and the salesperson shows you a pair of great wool slacks as opposed to a pair of cheap cotton ones and you say, gee, that's expensive. The salesperson might say, compared to what are these expensive? These will last you for years and years. You buy a cheap pair, yeah, they'll wear out a lot faster, they'll fray, and they won't look as good, and you have to replace them much sooner. So yes, the price may be more, but the cost will be less over the long term. If you're buying tools and you buy good quality tools, yes, it's going to cost more up front, the initial investment. However, the cheap set of tools will have to be replaced much sooner and more often than the quality set, and over the long term, they're going to be more expensive. So the initial investment may be higher, but the cost over time will be significantly lower. If you're buying a refrigerator and you say, gee, that's expensive, the salesperson might ask, compared to what is this expensive? Compared to a lesser quality refrigerator with less insulation, that will actually cost you more over the long term. This refrigerator will cost you less to operate over its lifetime. So yeah, go ahead, buy a cheaper one, but it's going to wind up costing you more in the long term. Once you give someone a value proposition, a value comparison, let them see the distinction between cost and price, between cost and value. Give them something to wrap a new story around, and you just may be able to close the sale or make the deal. This principle applies to virtually everything. If you're buying a set of tires, if you buy good quality tires, yes, they're going to cost more, and you might be inclined to say, gee, that's expensive. And by now you know the salesperson, it may even be you, is going to say, compared to what? These tires are guaranteed for 75,000 miles and they're puncture proof. Those cheap ones that cost less, they're only guaranteed for 12,000 miles. Which would you want in your car? Which would you want your family to be driving on? And you'll be replacing those cheap ones on a regular basis. So again, you know, the price may be more right now, but long term, the cost significantly less. You want to build in value. The price is not the most important item in the negotiation. Later on, we'll discuss that price is often the least important part. If you're buying a higher-end car, at some point, and the words may be a little bit different, but you might say or even think, gee, that's expensive. Well, by now you know the response. Compared to what? Compared to buying an inexpensive car, the repairs and maintenance will cost you more. The investment in this car includes a 100,000-mile warranty. The maintenance on the cheaper car, well, that's good for 10 or 20,000, and after that, you're on your own. The routine maintenance is included in the investment in this vehicle. And then, of course, you have the quality and workmanship. Would you rather have the rich leather seating in this vehicle or the cloth seats in the cheaper one? Those are going to wear out. This leather will last, and they'll be a lot more comfortable. The salesman is not only demonstrating why the price tag of this car is higher and better, she's building in the value. There was an article on MSNBC that went over the cost of buying a lesser quality car. They reported that the long-term cost of buying a cheaper car was actually more than the upfront cost of buying a higher quality and therefore more expensive car. The less expensive car actually costs more over the lifetime of the car. It is my personal belief that we all desire better quality and value, and all we need to do is justify or have our own story as to why we should have it. And a good salesman helps you build your own story and make your own decision about your purchase or your investment. It's the same thing when you're selling something. It is your responsibility to demonstrate the distinction between the cost of what you are selling and the value or benefit and the justification for the higher price. We are all making buying decisions on emotion more than logic. We may think it's logic, but it's the emotion behind it. It's a classic saying that logic tells and emotion sells. So when we get to the emotional story, we're more inclined to make the purchase. So is the person buying from you. Give them enough information to get their emotion involved and let them have a new story. So remember, cost versus value. In our next segment, we're going to talk about the importance of really listening. The importance of really listening, or what did he say? Many years ago, I was at a conference and the presenter asked a question. I'm going to repeat the question to you. If I have 26 sheep and one dies, how many do I have? I get all kinds of responses. You've got 26, but one is dead. You've got 25. I don't know. I haven't a clue. Well, I'll ask the question again. If I have 26 sheep and one dies, how many do I have left? Now, because this is a program about clear communication, I'm going to ask the question very, very slowly. The question is, if I have 20 sick sheep and one dies, how many do I have left? You may be groaning by now. Well, you see, it's the same question. We hear things through our own listening. That is through our own filter system. I have 26 sheep. I have 20 sick sheep. I know what you heard. It's because it's the same thing everybody hears. But whose responsibility is it to make sure the communication goes the way you would like it to? That means you hear what I want you to hear, what I'm really saying. That means I want you to hear what I really want to say. Speak clearly and articulate so the message is delivered as it is meant to be and listened to in the way you want it listened to. Here's a distinction. Hearing is one of the physical senses of the body, along with sight, smell, taste, and feel. Listening is the active part of taking the information in and giving it meaning. Remember, you are the one now learning empowering communication strategies, so it's up to you to make sure the communication is clear, going to them, or coming to you. If you are unclear about what somebody says, ask them to repeat it. And if you want to make absolutely certain that the person you are speaking with heard what you said, ask them to repeat it back to you. You may wonder, isn't someone going to be upset if I ask them to repeat it back to me? You know, I've never heard anyone complain or be insulted when they were asked to repeat something back. And I'll tell you where it shows up on a regular basis in your life. If you've ever given your credit card number to someone over the telephone, they repeat it back to you, perhaps number by number, number block by number block, or the whole series of numbers at one time, including the expiration date and the security code. I have never heard anyone complain or be insulted when they were asked to repeat something back. And I'll tell you where it shows up in your life on a frequent basis. If you've ever given your credit card to someone over the telephone, they repeat it back to you, perhaps number by number, number block by number block, or the whole series of numbers at one time, including the expiration date and the security code. And if you've taken a credit card over the phone, you have done the same thing. Or you ask someone to repeat it back, or they'll ask you to repeat the whole thing. Why do they do that? They want to make absolutely certain when they run the credit card, it's the right number and it goes through. They want to be certain that they understood what you said. I doubt you've ever been insulted. Someone's asked you to repeat the numbers back. And again, if you've taken them over the phone, no one's been insulted when you asked it. We don't get insulted. We expect it. Recently, I made a hotel reservation. All the information I gave the reservation, including the day of arrival, day of departure, billing address, telephone, request for a non-smoking room with a king-size bed, she repeated it back to me item by item. You know, we take these things for granted. It simply ensures, or at least enhances, accuracy. So you may want to consider this type of communication in other areas of your life as one way to enhance the level of communication. And there is another level of contributing to clearer communication. If you are like the rest of us, as I said earlier on, there have been times, aside from counting sheep, when someone said something and what you heard was not quite what they said. And there have been times when what you said was not quite what the other person heard. Well, we'll go into more detail about this later on, but the essence of this is put it in writing. Does this eliminate errors in communication? Absolutely not. But it sure helps reduce it. If I'm flying someplace and someone is supposed to meet me at the airport when I arrive, and I tell them over the phone the day, the flight, and arrival time, that's all well and good. But it does leave room for error. I don't know if they'll remember it, let alone if they even heard it. And who's at risk? Me. I don't want to be hanging around the airport. So I put it in writing. I will email them the same information, the day, the carrier, the flight, arrival time. Actually, today, if you book your flight online with most carriers, you'll not only receive an email confirmation, but you can have the same information sent to someone else, and if not, forward it to them. And this is all well and good, but you'll never know if they received the email. And if they did, did they read it? So we take it to the next level. Ask them, did you get the email? And if you get a yes answer, the odds of being met when you land improve significantly. These days, when I book a hotel for a conference and arrange for the hotel to send a car to pick me up, I love it when they send a confirmation email with my flight and the statement that someone will be waiting for me and where I should be meeting them. The odds are really good that I'll get picked up. Later on, we'll talk about the importance of going to the next level with the writing, and that's a contract. Many years ago, my son Jonathan told me a story about assuming someone else gets what we want them to get. Jonathan had a little meditation area in the corner of his room. One of the items he had there was a picture of someone who looked like a sage, a picture I had taken when I was in India. When the cleaning woman cleaned his room, she took the picture from the floor and put it on the nail in the wall, the picture hook where it had originally hung. Jonathan was very frustrated because each week he would take the picture off the wall and place it back on the floor in his meditation area. Each week, she put it back on the wall. Why doesn't she just get it, Dad? He asked me. I asked him if he ever told her he wanted the picture on the floor. No. She should know. I keep putting it there. Well, guess what? People don't just know. Never assume someone will get it from what you do or from what your desire is. Communicate clearly and you enhance the probability of a better outcome. When Jonathan finally told her what he wanted with clear communication, they laughed about the miscommunication, and the picture remained on the floor in his meditation center. It's just clear communication. So remember, what did he say? In our next segment, we'll talk about options. Before I get to the segment on options, I want to share a story with you about an experience I had in Australia. I was at a huge outdoor market. We were dealing primarily with one vendor, selecting several, actually a lot of articles of clothing and wonderful Australian products. The smile on the vendor's face was evident because we were collecting lots of hundreds of dollars worth of merchandise. When it appeared all was said and done and we were complete with our selections, the woman tallied up the merchandise and gave us a price. I looked at her and asked what has become one of my very favorite questions. What's the best price you can give us in this? I watched the woman's smile freeze upon her face, disappear, and turn to concern. She was not worried she was going to lose the sale. She was concerned that after spending close to an hour with us, we were going to simply turn around and walk away. She was obviously alarmed that she could lose a reasonably large sale. I didn't say anything. I simply waited in silence. Silence can be a very profound component of any negotiation, or actually any conversation. The other person almost always feels obligated to fill the emptiness. This can be one of the most devastating parts of a negotiation for somebody because of their being uncomfortable with silence. Most people are uncomfortable with silence in any conversation. She started, I can't take anything off the price. My prices are so low. It's the very price I can give you. I looked at her, smiled, and waited in silence. I mean, I may have said something like, oh. And it only took a moment before she said, and I can give you this, and I can give you this, and I can give you this. She picked up various items to be included with what we had already picked out at no cost to us. While she was committed to her price and unwilling to reduce it, she ultimately gave us to what in reality amounted to a 20% buying bonus. Not too bad. The lesson here is that price is not the only thing that's important or negotiable. In essence, we receive the equivalent of 20% more in merchandise for the same cost. You never know what's on the table. And we'll speak to that later on. The price is very often the least important part of any negotiation. So remember, no matter where you are, always ask. And one of my favorite questions in any negotiation is, what's the best price you can give me on this? Okay, now it's time for options. That's the next segment. Options and open-ended questions. Options are a good thing. I'm not talking about the kind you may trade in the market. I'm talking about offering options in any deal, in any negotiation, almost any conversation. Let's use a real simple example. If you see someone you have an interest in, and perhaps you'd like to invite that person to dinner, and you ask them, would you like to go to dinner tonight? A possible answer is no. Not exactly the outcome you desire. If you ask, would you like to go to dinner tonight or tomorrow night? While you've added an option, you still may get a no. And right now, you don't know if that person just doesn't want to go to dinner with you or they're not available tonight or tomorrow night. Questions that can be answered yes or no close the conversation, especially if you get a no answer. You see, if you begin the conversation with an open-ended question and then go to options, well, you have a better chance of finding out what's going on. So for the example of inviting someone to dinner, once you're well into a conversation, it's not an opening question, you might begin with a simple question such as, would you like to join me for dinner one evening? Now, if you get a no, that's a pretty good probability that the person doesn't want to go to dinner with you, and you're not going to get to offer options. However, if you do get a yes, well, now you're into the place of offering options. Which works better for you, this evening, tomorrow evening, or perhaps one evening next week? You have the continuing conversation. If you're buying a computer, for example, and you go into a store that sells computers, the first question the salesperson should ask is, what kind do you want? Do you want a laptop? Do you want a desktop? Do you want a Palm? Do you want Microsoft Surface? Do you want an iPad? Well, let's say we opt for a desktop. Now the salesperson should ask, what are you going to use it for? Open-ended. If you're simply going to use your computer for email and word processing, you don't need the same kind of options you might need if you're doing graphics and video. If you're doing graphics or video editing and gaming, you're going to need a different set of options on your computer. The salesperson would continue to ask questions about what you're doing. Do you want a 15, a 17, a 21-inch monitor? They all come around to the same option, the same question of what are you going to do with it. If you're buying a television, the salesperson would appropriately ask, what kind do you want? Do you want an LCD? Do you want plasma? How large a screen do you want? What's the environment you're going to watch it in? Is it a well-lit room? Is it a dark room? What questions do is put you into the options. What that means is the salesperson is offering you options so you can guide the sales process. And certainly, if you don't know the difference between these things and you cannot make a distinction of one over the other, ask the salesperson. If you don't know the difference between an LCD or a plasma, why you may want one over the other, ask. Get the salesperson involved. They're going to ask, do you want a high definition? My God, today almost every computer monitor or every television is high def. Do you want a small one? Do you want it for the kitchen? Do you want it for a theater room? What do you want it for? They're going to ask you questions, and you, on the other side as a salesperson, you're going to do the same thing. This way, someone, if it's you or you're buying something, you're in a better position to have needs fulfilled. The questions serve a purpose, multiple purposes, to find out what the client really wants and to further enroll them into the buying process. As they're defining what they want or you're defining what you want, you're more inclined, if you're really into the process of buying, to make the decision. If you're selling art, for example, and you happen to be an artist and someone comes into your gallery, you ask them, do you want oil? Do you like watercolor? What kind of art do you want? Do you want a giclée? Then, when they get to the place of actually purchasing a piece of art, you may ask them, do you want it framed? Do you want it unframed? Are you taking it with you? Are we shipping it? Options, options, options. If you're talking to a real estate agent, if you're buying a home, the agent is going to ask you if you want a new one or you want a previously owned one. The agent is going to ask what price range are you looking for? What kind of neighborhood are you interested in? Do you have children? Are you interested in schools? These options allow the person on the other side and you, when you're asking the questions, all the questions with options bring you closer to an alignment as to what it is you or they would like. Going on your vacation, if you happen to deal with a travel agent, the agent might ask, do you want a cruise? Do you want to be inland? Which country? Which state? Do you want mountain biking? Do you want to go scuba diving? Options allow you to fine-tune and keeps the conversations going. If you've ever bought a new car, you are actually shown a list of, and the list is titled, Options. What do you want with it? When you ask questions that can result in a yes or no answer, unless it's a desired outcome, you're going to end the conversation when the question gets answered. When you ask questions that have options or open-ended questions, you continue the conversation. Typical kinds of questions you've been asked when you're buying a car, for example. Will you be financing it? Or will we be financing it for you? Do you want to go to one of our lenders? Will you be paying us directly? If you're buying a house, the questions are exactly the same in this regard. Will we be arranging financing? Would you like us to find a lender? Or do you have your own financial resources? When you're going to dinner, business, professional, personal, doesn't matter, and you're asking someone, would you prefer the Italian, the Thai, the Indian, the seafood? Always options. In virtually every situation where a question can be asked, if your desire is to continue the conversation, you're much wiser to ask open-ended questions and questions that offer options. These allow the conversation to continue. So remember, options are a good thing. In our next segment, we'll discuss deferring to higher authority. Higher authority. This doesn't mean hire somebody with a gun or a badge or someone with more authority or power than you. This means deferring to higher authority, which is a very interesting tactic when used in negotiations. Most often it's used to gain wiggle room, and by the time you're done with this segment, you'll know this has been done to you or used on you, and you've probably used it yourself many times. Now you just have a name for it. Anytime someone says, I'll have to check with, that's deferring to higher authority. It takes you out of the moment of having to make a decision. It gives you plenty of room to play, and at least for the time being, either you or they, you don't have to make a decision. You're off the hook. And to whom you defer is really unimportant. Whether it's a husband, a wife, a CEO, a manager, an astrologer, it makes absolutely no difference. And in a few moments, I'll tell you what the counter to this is when it's used on you. So how does this show up? Let's say you're buying a car and the salesperson at some point will ask you a closing question, such as, well, are you ready to buy the car? And you say, I'll have to check with my wife. That's deferring to higher authority. And that's how you or the salesman find out if you're talking to the decision maker. Now, of course, if you're making a proposal to a company and you're dealing with a lower echelon person, certainly they may not be in a position to commit the company until it does go up the chain of command, most often with a written proposal. They may have to go to the president, the CEO, the board of directors, their astrologer. Again, it doesn't make a difference. It doesn't make a difference where it's going. It's your responsibility to find out who you're dealing with and about their level of responsibility and, more importantly, their authority, or lack of it, to make a decision. How do you find out? You ask them. If we agree on terms and everything meets with your approval, are you in a position to make the agreement and sign the contract? They may say yes, and they may say, no, I have to check with my board of directors. And that's fine, because at least you know where you now stand. One of the counters to this is very simple and very powerful, and it turns the other person into your advocate. You simply say, well, you will recommend it, won't you? You now have that person in a very interesting position. It is a very rare individual who will go through any level of negotiation, if they're in integrity, tell you they have to check with someone, and then say, no, I'm not going to recommend it. Especially after they just told you they have to defer to higher authority. If they do say no, well, you know the negotiation has gone south anyway, and you may as well just pack up and go home. So where may have you experienced that? If you've ever gone to a bank to secure a loan for a car or a house, and the loan officer you are speaking with says something like, "Great, I'll take your application to the loan committee." There is no loan committee. There is typically one person who's going to make the decision. And when you are speaking to the loan officer and they tell you they're taking it to the loan committee, you look at them and say, "Well, you will recommend it, won't you?" And there is another tactic to use when someone defers to higher authority. After acknowledging them for wanting to do that, and the reason you do that is you tell them, "I'm thrilled you want to talk to your husband or wife about this, because that means you get it. Otherwise, you wouldn't even want to talk about it. You wouldn't want to pass it along." And again, this situation doesn't play out in a business setting where someone has to give his report, written or oral, to a higher person within the company, or the written proposal must be passed up the chain of command. This particular scenario would play out when someone wants to defer to a spouse or a business partner, for example. You simply ask this person, "Do you remember the game telephone we used to play when we were in grade school?" You whisper something in someone's ear, and they whisper it in someone else's ear, and they whisper it to someone else, and by the time it comes around the circle back to you, it's nowhere close to what you started with. Well, that's my concern here. As this gets repeated, the essence may get lost in translation. Actually, it may even get somewhat distorted. So, when can I speak with your wife? Or when can I speak with your husband? When can I speak with your office manager? When can we get them on the phone? Or when can I come over and speak with the two of you together? I want to make certain we get this absolutely clear, because the fact that you've got it is so great. I want to ensure the message gets delivered with my passion, my enthusiasm, my excitement, and quite frankly, my expertise in this situation. Can we get them on the phone right now so we can all get together? I recall a situation when I was teaching this process during a teleclass. A young man who had been on a prior teleclass and returned to this one, he wanted to report his success. He was actually raising seed capital for an early stage business. As Elliot related the story, he was quite enthusiastic to report his remarkable success. He told the participants on the conference call how he approached a friend of his to invest several $1,000s in his early stage business. While his friend was enthusiastic about participating, he said, "Elliot, that's great, but I've got to check with my wife on this." Elliot reported he did exactly what you just heard here. He congratulated the person and asked when he could speak with his prospect's wife directly. As Elliot continued the story, he said the prospect asked him, "Well, exactly how much do you need?" Elliot said, "Well, what I need next is $5,000. As Elliot bubbled with enthusiasm sharing his story, he said his friend said, "Oh, okay." And he took out his checkbook and wrote a check for $5,000. You see, this really works. Remember, you defer to higher authority when you need an escape clause, anytime you're not ready to make a decision. And when it is used on you, you simply say, "Well, you will recommend it, won't you?" So remember, higher authority. In the next segment, which is on the next CD, we'll talk about sense.